You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad to have you here, and we're going to begin our Seattle show in Standing Rock, North Dakota, where protesters celebrated yesterday. That's because the Army Corps of Engineers denied access to an easement for building that controversial oil pipeline. Linda Mapes is an environment reporter for the Seattle Times, and she told me why protesters are right to see this denial as a victory for now.
In its decision, the Corps said that the tribe has raised concerns about the effects of a spill polluting their drinking water and also effects on cultural resources, and further, lack of consultation and the need for a full environmental impact statement to include a review of alternative routes.
The energy company building this pipeline says they are going to go ahead with the pipeline anyway, so why is this a big victory?
You know, I don't think that's an accurate reading of their statement. If you read it closely, what it says is that they do not think there will be an alternative route. That's not the same thing as saying that they're going to get cracking and start drilling. It has to be understood that I can't imagine a contractor of the sort that is needed for this major job that would do some kind of pirate, rogue, middle-of-the-night drilling operation. I mean, first of all, Michael's Construction out of Brownsville, Wisconsin, which is a nearly 100-year-old company and one of the largest in the nation that does this horizontal directional drilling work. In fact, they're a major contractor on Sound Transit. They're not going to risk their people and their equipment and, frankly, their reputation on going out there and starting to drill under the Missouri River when the Army Corps of Engineers, the federal government, has told them they don't have a right to be there. I mean, they're not going to do that. This isn't some, like, middle-of-the-night quick operation. It's a big deal, very expensive, very sophisticated.
So if the company's saying we don't think there'll be a rerouting, what are they saying, that the project's finished?
They
just think they'll get this from the Trump administration instead of the Obama administration?
Yeah, I mean, they think they will prevail under either a different scenario in which no EIS ever happens because somehow they overturn a court victory. They'd have to have a court victory, right? You'd have to see a scenario in which under the Trump administration they would say, oh, forget it, you know, we don't need that EIS, we're going to give you the easement, go to it.
Could the Trump administration do that?
They can do that, but you know what happens next? Of course, the tribe instantly sues and says, actually, no, you know, we have a finding by an administrative agency that says we need to do a full environmental impact statement for the reasons they stated. It was not arbitrary and capricious. It's a finding by a federal agency, and you'd have to go to court and adjudicate that. You know, they can't just, you know, tweet it and make it so. I mean, you got to fight this stuff out through governmental and administrative processes, so... You know, this is a big deal, and you know, I quoted John Hasselman from Earth Justice today in the Seattle Times saying, you know, this isn't a hoax, this is real, you know, people should just go home. I mean, they won, you know, it's not a small thing, it's not a minor matter, it's a big deal, and they can't just, you know, wish it away or make it go away.
So Energy Transfer Partners doesn't want to reroute the pipeline, but could that happen? If you're saying that it would be a big fight under even a Trump administration, but could the pipeline just go in a different place, or does it have to go through Standing Rock's claim?
No. Let's all remember, it originally was going to go through a different place. It was going to go north of Bismarck, the capital city of North Dakota, and there was concern about this is ironic in retrospect, the municipal wellheads. And so the company rerouted the pipeline to take it down to Indian Country, to take it within a half a mile of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation border and within 10 miles of their drinking water intake. For the company, it was cheaper, and it got them out of a situation of concern about the water supply for the city of Bismarck. And what the Standing Rock Sioux says to that is, I don't think so.
So then, Linda, what is your prediction?
You know, I think that what we're all going to have to do is live with this process for a while. I mean, it's going to be up in the air. The Army Corps has spoken. That doesn't go away because the company doesn't like it. And it doesn't instantly go away when Donald Trump takes office. You know, if Energy Transfer wants to sue and fight this, that's what they'll do. And the tribe will push back. I mean, this is not going to go away quickly, but it is certainly, I cannot imagine a scenario in which you suddenly see some drilling rigs starting up in the middle of the night in North Dakota. It's over, at least for now.
at least for now. We talked on KUOW with an attorney for Native claims, Gabe Galanda, who said he's afraid of a congressional backlash against protesters and that life gets harder for tribes.
That could happen. That could certainly happen. But you know what? It's never been easy. And, you know, the fortitude and the resources of Indian tribes is something that people have got to be noticing by now. I mean, this started at Cherry Point at the Lummi Nation, and it started last May.
Near Bellingham, for listeners who don't know Cherry Point,
and
the terminal,
you know,
coal terminal.
That tribe defeated fully and solely on the strength of its reserved treaty rights, a $625 million coal port, the largest ever proposed in North America and desperately wanted by coal companies that want to ship coal by train to Asian ports. And they didn't get it. And, you know, that was noticed. And it was noticed around the world, and it was noticed around Indian country. And so now here comes Standing Rock. And you know what's next? Trans Mountain. I mean, BC opposed it. The city of
this
Vancouver.
Is the expansion of the pipeline from Alberta to the Vancouver area.
Exactly, and it's tar sands, dirtier oil, and it's bigger. It's bigger than Standing Rock. It's bigger than Keystone. And, you know, there are First Nations in BC that oppose that. There are First Nations elsewhere in Canada that oppose it. There are tribal nations in Salish country on the Washington side of the border that oppose it, and environmentalists on both sides of the border that oppose it. You know, if this is what building an oil pipeline looks like in rural North Dakota, I can't even imagine what it's going to look like if Kinder Morgan tries to bring a tar sands pipeline to Metro Vancouver.
That's Linda Mapes, environment reporter for the Seattle Times, looking to the future for the oil pipeline at Standing Rock and to our north at the pipeline that ends near Vancouver, British Columbia. Coming up on The Record, you're going to get to know a man who played a big part in the so-called Indian Wars in that part of the country in the Midwest, George Custer, coming up in The Record in about 15 minutes. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. In Seattle, companies are having trouble finding workers. The unemployment rate here is much lower than most other places, so companies that want to hire people have got to get creative.
So in that sense, you have to stand out. How do you beat Facebook? How do you beat Amazon if you're a small startup? Maybe you talk about the community. Maybe you talk about the neighborhood.
You talk about your neighborhood. A growing number of companies are making the neighborhood where they're located part of their brand. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols has more.
Tableau makes software that helps people turn data into fancy, pretty visuals for the web. Tableau is based in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood, right next to the Ship Canal. It probably doesn't matter to the people who buy Tableau's software where that software is made, but to the employees, location is key.
We even have some people who kayak to work, which is very Seattle. I love that.
Do they live in houseboats or something?
No, they don't. They just live close to the water, and so they'll walk down to the water with their little inflatable kayak and hop on in and head on over.
That's Joni Kimsey, director of recruiting at Tableau. She says Fremont hits all the things people love about Seattle. There's culture, there's water, and it's just a little bit eccentric. It's a place where you can strip naked and ride a bicycle in a parade. And it has a very clear brand of its own. It's the center of the universe.
I think it's just become kind of embedded within our culture. You know, our founders chose Fremont over 11 years ago as the place where they really wanted to have this company. And we've continued to stay here. It's become an important part of who we are.
Do you talk about Fremont when you're recruiting people to come to this office?
Definitely. You know, I think the neighborhood itself is a big draw. It was for me when I joined.
Tableau has expanded to other offices all around the world, and they've got another local office in Kirkland. Kimsey says whenever they've scouted out a new location,
we've actually really purposefully looked for office space and locations and neighborhoods that reflect what we have here in Fremont.
That means avoiding big downtowns, for example. For Tableau, the neighborhood has been part of the company's brand since its founding. But it doesn't always work that way. Other companies move to new neighborhoods when they need to reinvent themselves. They look for neighborhoods that have also recently rebranded. Places like Pioneer Square. It was a neighborhood fallen on hard times. Now it has a new story. The neighborhood hired a branding consultant to help with that.
They recommended that we lead with food.
Leslie Smith and the Alliance for Pioneer Square lured in a celebrity chef. Other chefs followed.
People follow restaurants, retail follows food, and all of a sudden, there's a new economy here and a new story. All of a sudden, we're getting picked up in Bon Appetit and Sunset Magazine, and it's like, wow, time to go check out what's going on in Pioneer Square.
Enter Weyerhaeuser, a timber company founded more than a century ago. Its baby boomer employees were retiring, and young workers weren't as excited about its 45-year-old corporate campus in suburban Federal Way. I mean, it was fine, but
employees are looking for more diverse urban environments to work in.
That's Weyerhaeuser's Jack Evans. He says Pioneer Square will help the company attract a younger workforce. They needed a new neighborhood to help people see the company in a new light.
I mean, I think most of us have an image of the timber industry that, you know, it's a bunch of guys with handlebar mustaches, you know, sitting on a giant log, you know. It's changed, right? And certainly there are positions in this office, in this building, that didn't exist 116 years ago when the company was founded. But there are important roles. There's a lot going on to manage a forest, and some of it happens out in the forest, and some of it happens in front of a computer screen.
Weyerhaeuser could have relocated to South Lake Union, but honestly, they would have seemed like posers in that environment, don't you think? Here in Pioneer Square, the little nods to nostalgia that you might see in a tech startup office, they feel authentic here. Elizabeth McPherson is one of the building's designers. She's with Methune. She points out a table made from an old log. Weyerhaeuser employees call it Cookie.
And it's obviously a slice from one of their trees with some industrial big casters on it.
A table like that would fit in a hipster's living room. But in a timber company's headquarters in Pioneer Square, what other kind of table would you expect? And then in the lobby, giant video screens make it look like you're walking through a forest on a sunny day.
And to me, this is a pretty powerful space. One of the interests that they had was to have sort of the old and the new be present.
On the outside, Weyerhaeuser's building is modern. It's got a mirrored surface. But reflected in that surface, you can see the historic buildings, the tall trees and brick pavers of Occidental Park. It's a conversation and a brand story that feels right at home in Pioneer Square.
This is a place where the Northwest timber industry got its start. Yesler Way is a block away. It's where they used to skid grease logs down to the Yesler Mill 100 plus years ago.
Oh, and by locating here in Pioneer Square, Weyerhaeuser can compete for workers who might choose to work at Starbucks just down the street in Soto or Amazon. But a company has to be kind of careful if it's going to start thinking about a neighborhood as part of its brand. That's because branding is partly about simplifying your message, and neighborhoods are complicated. For example, Fremont is quirky, but it's also a place that's become much harder for the artists who made it quirky to afford to live there. And Pioneer Square is full of history, but it's also the place where a lot of homeless people get their services.
A company can't just take ownership of Fremont, can't just take ownership of Pioneer Square. They really need to include the community members.
Jeff Schulman teaches marketing at the University of Washington. He says companies need to be careful how they tell the story of a neighborhood. They need to start by asking questions.
Understanding who's there, who your neighbors are, and what are they excited about? What are they fearful of? And trying to be a part of that conversation instead of driving it.
If companies don't do that, they have a risk of being seen as destructive. That's when you get things like neighborhoods protesting Google buses. But if companies and neighborhoods work together and really listen to each other, they can pull each other up. In Pioneer Square, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
You can find that story along with related information, including photos, at our website, KUOW.org.
Well, at least the Huskies won't have to play in the snow. It's not Green Bay, right, Percy Allen?
Yeah, there's always that.
Seattle Times reporter Percy Allen, sports reporter, in now to talk to us because the Husky football team spent the weekend winning and then waiting.
Yes.
The UW won the Pac-12 conference championships, beat up on Colorado. Then they had to wait to find out whether that's good enough to get them into the college football playoffs with a chance to be national champions. Percy, last week you guaranteed the Huskies would be national champions.
play the tape. All right, let's play the tape.
Technically, you did not, but it was a good headline. That's so right. Let me first ask you, why did the Huskies have to sit around this weekend and wait to see what other people think of them?
You know, well, because their resume, that their record was just debatable. You know, that there's other teams out there that thought that they belonged in there. You know, most notably Penn State. Most notably Michigan, and so yeah, there was a debate as to who would be the four teams that would play for the national title. I think everybody believed that Alabama would be one of the four.
Obviously, they're the undefeated ones,
right? And then Ohio State, simply because of their resume, simply because of their body of work, belonged in that conversation. Clemson was, 12-1. They were in the title game last year, and so they have done enough. And then it came to Washington, and then quite frankly, there was a long debate.
And who are the debaters? Who are the people deciding?
You know,
what's so special about them?
You know, so 3 years ago, when college football went to this system, they put 12 people in a committee. And these 12 people are former coaches, former athletic directors, current athletic directors.
Former secretaries of state.
Here we go. Yes. Condoleezza Rice.
Why Condoleezza Rice?
I think that they wanted some diversity in that committee, that there's also former sports reporter in that committee. So I like that aspect of it, that, you know, basically you have 9 people who are just really these hardcore football people. And then you've got these sort of 3 kind of wild card folks who, you know, sort of bring in a different thought process to it.
And why the coach who gave the Huskies their only winless season in the history of the school?
Well, again, he's one of the former coaches. And so,
did he owe us a favor?
Nothing like that, no. Okay. But he also coached at Notre Dame and at Stanford. So, you know, technically that his resume is there. Now, the thing about this is that these are only 3-year terms. And so these people are out the door. And so next year you'll have 12 new people.
They're going to go into the private sector and make a lot of millions of dollars lobbying for the college football
program. Or, you know, they'll write some books or some manuals or something like that. But, yeah, I'm sure that they'll try to get paid some way.
So they decided the Huskies are in the college playoffs and that UW is the worst of the 4 teams in there, which means they have to play the best team, yeah, which is the Alabama Crimson Tide. Who they were Super Bowl champions last year.
No, they were not.
They were not.
No.
But they're very good. Yeah. Is this what the Huskies wanted, to play Alabama for?
Well, they wanted to get in, you know, and so sometimes you can't control that sort of where you are. And so,
but would you rather play Alabama right away at the very end?
No. Yeah, so obviously you want to play Alabama at the very end, uh-huh, if you can, but that's out of their control. I mean, they had nothing to do with that, and so they're just happy to be in. I mean, you know, you
don't patronize the Huskies.
Well, but you can't win the title unless you are playing in the games here, and so they would much rather play Clemson or Ohio State. And also, had they played Clemson or Ohio State, if they were not number 4, that game would be in Phoenix as opposed to Atlanta, which is basically Alabama's backyard.
Yeah. So Alabama, if you don't know, they're undefeated. They demolish teams. It's like the high school team in Everett, Archbishop Murphy. It's not fair that anybody has to play them.
You know, Alabama is one of the blue bloods of college football. I mean, you know, we're talking about 16 national titles. We're talking about Bear Bryant. We're like talking about 4 national titles in the past 7 years. You know, they are very good. They are arguably the best in college football over the past, again, 7 years here.
So what do the Huskies do? Forfeit?
No, they don't forfeit. No, you show up and you play the game. Look, so they have a fantastic coach here by Chris Peterson who, you know, he's done this before. When he was at Boise State, a smaller school, they would play these bigger schools in these bowl games, and they would have, again, kind of like what we have now, 2 to 3 weeks to prepare for this one game. And lo and behold, Boise State would beat teams like Oklahoma, you know, sort of big, tough Oklahoma,
yep,
and they would just do it by just, one, being fundamentally better. And then they would also throw in some trick plays, which now that's what fans remember are the trick plays, the sort of the razzle dazzle stuff. And, you know, by goodness, it worked. I mean, and it was fun to watch. That like they would just break out this, what? Where's the ball? It's over there.
They hit the ball.
And truly, it would be like Three Stooges football. And you know what I mean? I mean, like literally, they would tuck the ball underneath their jerseys. And
get it out of your pants.
And you would look through the rule like, is that even legal? And then, you know, and so the Oklahoma coach was just going, you know. But so that's kind of what Chris Peterson has in his playbook. That's, you know, that's kind of what he's known for. Is he going to do that this time around? I don't know, but it's a possibility.
Wow, this is going to be fun. Prediction.
Well, the Huskies are a 14-point underdog. So that's a lot. That is the most in the history of the college football playoffs. And now, granted, this is only the third year. That's a big number. I don't see – and, you know, I would like to think that Washington has a chance. I know I'm talking a lot, and I'm sort of trying to build this up here. But
answer the question.
I know,
sir.
Right? It's Alabama, and I just can't see right now Washington going there and winning that game. But I think that they'll play well. I'm not even sure that they'll keep it close, but I think that they'll play well.
Wow. But maybe some razzle-dazzle.
Sure.
All right.
Yes.
Seattle Times sports reporter Percy Allen. Good to see you again. Thanks, Percy.
Thank you, my man. Take care.
KOW is The Record. The Record on KUOW Seattle, continuing now. I'm Bill Radke. You know, a few minutes ago, we were talking about the Standing Rock Reservation protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now you're going to get to know a man who played a pivotal role in the contentious history between the U.S. government and Native people in that part of the country. George Custer was complicated. Pulitzer Prize-winning author T.J. Stiles describes Custer as a buckskin-clad outdoorsman and Indian fighter, urbane theater lover, loving brother and son, and avowed white supremacist. Stiles' book is called Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. I asked him why he wanted to learn more about George Custer and why contemporary America has to learn from him.
In a historical sense, I wanted to know more about him because, again, of these contradictions and because of the ways in which he reflects the way America came to be the way it is now. And both those people who helped push that process forward and those who resisted, and both sides of that, pushing things forward and also resisting, continue to this day. And Custer actually played a role in both sides, helping to change America and also resisting some of those changes.
Change and resistance, boy, we still live that every day, don't we?
Yeah, there's a figure who I believe ran for president who had the slogan, Making America Great Again. I forget his name, but anyway.
I've heard.
Yeah. This is the theme, actually, of Custer's life in a way, because he was someone who became a brigadier general thanks to both merit and connections at the age of 23 during the Civil War. But he was catapulted into this combat role at the moment of greatest peril for the United States ever. And actually at one of the decisive moments on the eve of the Battle of Gettysburg. So he became a boy general, as he was called, on the eve of one of the most consequential battles in American history, and he performed exceptionally well. There's no way around it. He wasn't just lucky. He wasn't just brave. He was actually a very capable and inspirational and charismatic combat leader. And for that reason, he was beloved by his men. He was someone who became a national hero. But there was another aspect to him, which that later on flowed into such areas as politics, which is the fact that he represented an earlier America that was being challenged by the Civil War and then by the other changes that followed along with it. He was a romantic figure. He was an individualist. He cultivated this chivalric air, the air of gallantry, with his elaborate custom uniform that he made for himself, with his long flowing hair, with his devil-may-care style. He deliberately crafted an image, and that image was of a more romantic, earlier America that people felt was slipping away in the mass warfare and in the organizational future that the Civil War brought in.
You say he was heroic, he was villainous.
I think of George Custer, I think that history has decided he was more of a villain. Maybe it's because I'm in one of those liberal bubbles. But how was he heroic besides his, was it just his Civil War success?
Yeah, that's the main thing in terms of his heroism, in terms of his accomplishments that are, I think, across the board people would consider constructive accomplishments. He was from a border state culture. He's from southern Ohio, from a Maryland-born father. He was a Democrat who had more southern affinities than northern. When it came to politics, he was a loyal, you know, citizen of the United States, a loyal army officer. He believed in the Union, a very kind of border state attitude. But he accepted slavery. Ironically, he helped to destroy slavery. And he even used it as a talking point when he was trying to curry favor with radical Republican politicians. He claimed at one point to have freed more slaves than any other general in the army. It's not true, but he certainly helped many, many enslaved people find freedom. But what happened is, as the war ended, Custer confronted a personal crisis that was also a national crisis. Now that we've won the war and we've destroyed slavery, what does that mean? What kind of nation do we want to come out of this?
Well, you write about how Andrew Johnson, who became president after Lincoln's assassination, fought with Congress over the shape of Reconstruction. Johnson was against any civil rights protections for freed slaves, and Custer supported Johnson on that.
Exactly right. Custer goes on tour with Andrew Johnson. As a serving regular army officer, he's giving political speeches. He's openly supporting Andrew Johnson. He was a delegate to Johnson's political convention. And as a result, he went from being a great national hero as a result of his Civil War leadership to becoming intensely controversial. And he was seen in a very partisan way. Democrats who favored white supremacy openly backed him. Republicans weren't all racial egalitarians, but it was very much kind of framed in terms of an extension of the Civil War. And they saw Custer as a traitor. And so when he went west and he started to have troubles in the West, it's the politics that have made him controversial first. It is the fact that he's thrown himself into the doorway to try to stop the constitutional foundations of the America that we have today, one in which there's racially neutral citizenship, in which there are federal protections for the individual for their civil rights. These are all new things that Custer opposes.
So when you hear about the Donald Trump election and this debate over what place white nationalism has in America, are you thinking about George Custer?
Yeah, it's not that. I mean, again, you know, there's two things we have to do. One is we can't make simple equations because Custer is a product of the 1850s and 1860s. You know, he increasingly makes a point of intervening in politics as an army officer and on the side of white supremacy. Now we come 150 years later to an America in which the, you know, political civility, political standards have been such that, you know, we both parties have at least, you know, at least in terms of rhetoric, embraced the idea of America being a place open to all. And along comes Donald Trump, who talks in explicitly racial terms. Even Paul Ryan said that Donald Trump's comment about the judge hearing the Trump University fraud case, even Paul Ryan says that's pretty much the definition, textbook definition of racism.
This is the judge born in Indiana but with Mexican ancestry.
That's exactly right. And so this is really startling. Now, the existence of those kinds of tensions, the kind of them versus us tensions, the America first, as Trump puts it. You know, these, of course, you know, in a nation that had slavery, this goes back, you know, to before the founding of the Republic. You know, at the moment when civil rights are being invented, that's when you have kind of the formation of, you know, forms of racism and an argument for a racial identity as an American identity. Takes place kind of in opposition to it. They're kind of intertwined in not that racism was born because of civil rights, but the specific way in which people responded to it.
Let's talk about another past-present echo. George Custer's most famous battle, I suppose, is his last stand in Eastern Montana Territory, what he was fighting some of the part of the same tribe that is now fighting against this proposed Dakota Access Pipeline.
And there's some interesting things to draw out about this, which is that the people who are really on the side of expanding the idea of American identity and of civil rights in the South, when they come west, their idea is we are going to integrate Native people into the United States and make them citizens. So that's actually explicitly destructive of their sovereignty, autonomy, and cultural distinctiveness. Their religious distinctiveness, their languages, their everything that makes them their own people and their own nations. So the same Congress that passed the Ku Klux Klan Act in 1871, putting the federal government in charge of enforcing voting rights for the first time and protecting individuals from terrorist groups attacking people's right to vote, that same Congress passed a law saying no more treaties with Indian nations. We're not going to treat them as sovereign entities anymore. And so when you look at the roots, this is not to get, you know, delve into all the details of the Standing Rock dispute, but it ultimately comes down to the fact that that again and again, Native nations have not been the sense of them being sovereign entities has not been respected, and that the United States has kind of gone back and forth, and there's been, you know, neglect even during some of the least oppressive periods, that this idea that they are their own people. And as individuals, they have every right to be, you know, as integrate themselves as fully into the rest of the nation as they want to. But as a group, they deserve respect as sovereign people. And this is really, I think, the root of the crisis that's happening right now at Standing Rock. Myself, that's my own view.
Will you say a little more about that? How is that root playing into the headlines our listeners are seeing?
Well, let's take the fact that in this kind of smallest way, the most detailed way, one of the big complaints is that there were insufficient consultations. And, you know, there were some contacts, there might have been some messages sent, but the idea that they had to really be taken seriously, the people...
That the pipeline building company didn't consult enough with...
Yeah, and that the Army Corps of Engineers didn't really consult with them, and they just didn't, they don't feel like they've been engaged. And there are people on the other side saying, well, we tried, et cetera. But you have to put it in this context of how the treatment of Indians has been unilateral. There's a way in which the sort of sense of environmental threat and degradation, there's crossed wires. And that's been true from the very beginning in the dealings of the U.S. with Native people. And I think, again, that's a part of the historical context in which this environmental conflict is taking place.
So we come back to the man at the center of so many of these stories and at the center of your book, Custer's Trials. In the preface of your book, you said that you wanted, quote, to examine Custer's life as it was lived in order to better grasp the man, his times, and his larger meaning. So you've made that examination. What is George Custer's larger meaning to you?
Well, I think that Custer really reflects a number of different things that are really worth thinking about. You know, why was it that millions of Americans resisted civil rights? Well, you see it in this one life. So here's a human being who, even at his most, most exasperating self, is a vivid human being we can really recognize and understand, and he's facing an America that's undergoing huge changes. So how is it that people deal with times of great change? How is it that people deal with a world in which the individual seems to be diminished by organizations and government and these larger things that seem to overshadow our lives? And Custer responded to changes and to a sense of threat to the world in which he'd, you know, come of age in ways that I think we can really understand, even if we can't accept the ways in which he reacted in many ways. And it's an amazing American story that I think really has resonance for today.
T.J. Stiles, author of the book Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for History. We were talking there about the Indian fighter and Civil War hero, George Custer, and the Standing Rock Pipeline protests. And my next guest knows about all of those things. Robbie Robertson, songwriter and guitarist with the band. His mother was a member of a First Nations tribe in Canada, and he wrote the song The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down about the defeat of the Civil War Confederacy, that and a lot of other classic songs. Robertson was in Seattle last week on a book tour for his new memoir. It's called Testimony, and he told me why he makes a point of coming to the Northwest.
I have an appreciation for this place. Part of it would be that so much amazing music came out of this place. There was some kind of a special thing in the air here that just kept bringing it out. And then with that and the amazement of technology here and the fact that it's not far from the Canadian border, a big part of this for me, too, is this is also Indian country. And that's part of my growing up, part of my heritage.
Your mother was Mohawk?
Yeah.
And you were raised on an Iroquois reservation in Canada?
Well, the Iroquois Nation, which is actually called the Haudenosaunee, is the six nations that united many hundred years ago. And so my mother was born and raised on the Six Nation Indian Reserve. And so it was a big part of my growing up, big part of my introduction to music and the storytelling as well.
Are you following the Standing Rock Pipeline protests? Is that interesting? What are you thinking about that?
Well, I think it's just horrible. It's just another sign of such greed, such imposition on the people. And, you know, I don't want to get too caught up in this, but it is just one more horrible thing for the original people of North America. Just leave them alone. Show some respect. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. Take your money and get out of the way.
We're getting a little political here. I wonder...
You told me it was going to be a party, and now, you know, I'm getting all upset.
Well, the songs you're most famous for, anyway, take up the point of view of people who you, as you said, aren't the top of the ladder. You said you're more interested in the gambler, the trucker, the rural man and woman fishing with dynamite. I have wondered, would those characters, is that red state America? Would those be Trump voters today?
Oh, I don't know. I'm from Canada.
Are you interested in the American election?
Yeah, I'm interested in it. It's a bit abstract for me to really wrap my head around. I'm happy, you know, in Canada that there's somebody that really feels responsible, caring, has a depth, is concerned about all people. Justin Trudeau, you know, I mean, it's early on, but it seems like he's a genuine soul and somebody who really cares. What's going to happen in the United States, you know, we're going to find out. And all we can do is really hope that this idea that anybody could come to America and become president isn't a joke.
What do you think about being a Canadian who gets so much credit for Americana, the Americana musical movement?
Well, I have to say it's called North Americana.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's because when I was 16 years old, I went from Canada down to join a rock and roll band in the South. And it made an incredible impression on me because I was going to the holy land of rock and roll, going to the South. That's where it grew out of the ground. And my eyes were so wide and innocent, and I took it in to such a degree. And it was almost like a spiritual experience for me. So that washed over me. And when I was writing songs and for me trying to discover an authenticity in what I could write about, there was something so mythological and true mythology in all of this that I soaked it up to the degree that it came out years later in my songwriting.
How did that feel to be a First Nations person, a Jewish person, your father, and you're touring the American South? What was your identity there? Because you could have passed, you look like a white guy.
Yeah. Well, that was the trick. You know, early on, my mother said very clearly, be proud that you're an Indian, but be careful who you tell. And so at an early age, I just went with the Canadian part. I didn't go into too much detail because to be a Jewish redskin could mean you need to wait in the car. It could be that we don't have any seats inside for you. So,
did you find that out firsthand?
Well, I found it out in ways, but it never – I was so forward musically. I was so pushing my mission of music forward that I didn't resort back to heritage that much. I didn't have to. And like you said, I could pass for whatever.
I just kind of wonder what feeling you have from the traveling you did and the stories you told.
It was a wondrous education to be out there for the early days with the Hawks, which in this book, you know, when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about it from the point of view of then. When I was 16 years old and I started doing this, and I was discovering what was going to happen next. And that's the way that I wanted to write this book. I didn't know what was around the corner. And so, and
it's not a chronological book,
no,
so much as scenes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I had to do it to my own instinct is to be drawn to kind of a cinematic structure in it. But I was frustrated at a certain point that I was missing out on a kind of normality of growing up and going to school and doing the normal things. I didn't want the normal things. I chose this other way, but I felt a piece missing, and I tried to make up for that in literature and reading and studying in my own self-educational way. And the traveling and the places, there was a lot to take in, and there was a lot to be learned, and there was a lot to grasp from all the musicalities that lay by the side of the road that we picked up as we went along. And as we gathered and gathered, it became a musicality unto itself. So when the band made their first recording, it was a culmination of a lot of this code of the road and a lot of these musicalities. And it came out, it sure wasn't trendy. It wasn't trying to be, you know, what other things were trying to be at all. It was trying to be absolutely honest and the most musical that we could possibly be. And with the different characters in the band and what everybody brought to the table, it wasn't like a singer with no shirt on and a cute guitar player and some other guys in the back.
You were pretty cute.
Well, you know, we won't go into that. But, you know, I tried to hide that behind beards for years.
Is that right? You talked about trendy. The band style, the vintage threads and the beards and the hats, you see that in Seattle and Brooklyn. Kind of, it's a hipster thing now. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I see a lot of things that do remind me of that. The band was living up in the mountains, up in Woodstock, New York. And this wasn't, we weren't wearing an outfit. We weren't dressing for anything. This was just the way it felt natural to where we lived. And I don't know, living up in the mountains, you didn't feel like, geez, I need to shave every day.
Yeah.
It wasn't a look. It was just the way we were. And the fact that it rubbed off onto the culture baffled us in the beginning. And we thought, isn't that funny? People actually think that that's a way to look.
I work with a guy who looks like, who reminds me of your look.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, more than one.
Well, tell him to snap out of it.
Either go move to the mountains or get your own thing. Okay, finally, very quickly, two lyrical questions I always wanted to ask you. The night they drove Old Dixie down, I can understand why people were sad, angry. Why were they singing na, 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 na?
Oh, Well, because it is a lament.
That's a lament they're singing.
Yeah. And in the South, you know, it's quite traditional that you hear sad laments for all kinds of occasions. And I just had to have it.
Okay. I thought that was just, you know, Levon filling a couple of bars.
No.
That was a lament.
Yeah.
Does the narrator just want Fanny to take a load off, or Carmen and Luke and Chester? Because Fanny's not there, right? She's back home.
Right.
Yeah.
He's just paying well wishes on her behalf.
Those are her regards that she's sending.
That's right. Oh. That's right. So, you know, it's one of those things. You try to be a gentleman. You try to show up. You try to help somebody out. And sometimes it turns you on your head.
Yeah, you said no good deed goes unpunished.
There you go.
This guy's taking everybody's burdens. Robbie Robertson, thank you for coming.
Thank you. This was fun. Take a load off.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Is Seattle going to build a new sports arena in SoDo? Well, a reason not to do that is to protect the business of shipping goods in and out of the port of Seattle. But that port business has gotten shakier lately, as the Puget Sound Business Journal reports. The journal's editor-in-chief is Emily Parkhurst. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You report that the most urgent risk to the port is not this arena, it's what's happening in the shipping business. How so?
Yeah, that's exactly true. You know, the shipping business right now is truly struggling, and some folks might be aware of the Hanjin bankruptcy that happened several months ago.
This is the Korean shipping outfit. Huge.
Massive shipping outfit. And they entered bankruptcy protection, and that has had enormous fallout for the Port of Seattle and for ports all across the country and the world, frankly. And Hanjin is not the only shipping company that's really struggling. They're just one of many. And, you know, that has huge implications for Seattle, which has just tremendous dependence on port operations for our economy.
Shipping companies are struggling. The journal writes that freight volumes are dwindling. Why is that happening?
You know, it's a number of reasons. You know, we're seeing a slowdown in the Chinese economy, and so that slowdown in demand has dramatically affected the shipping volumes. It's also oil prices remain low, and that has an impact on the shipping industry. And it's a combination of those things. And then if you look back, there was the recession, of course, and that had a huge impact. And just before the recession, a lot of these shipping companies invested in very, very large ships to respond to demand then. And so they were heavily leveraged to begin with. And then we had this this slowdown in the economy, and that really affected all of them.
Businesses have high and low points. How much do you think this shipping slowdown situation can affect the average Seattleite when it comes to our economy and the port?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the estimates are that about 40% of Puget Sound area jobs rely on port operations, just in one way or another, for their business. So that's a huge economic impact right there. It's also, when you look at this terminal that we focused in on for this story, Terminal 46, which is just across the street from CenturyLink Field, that is run by a terminal operator that is majority owned by Hanjin. So if that terminal operator is struggling and Hanjin owes them $54 million right now, if that terminal operator pulls out, that's a terminal that's no longer operating, and that has a huge economic impact.
So there's the backdrop. Back to the stadium now. How do these business concerns affect the stadium question?
You know, I think if you go back to earlier this year when the city of Seattle declined to basically grant Chris Hansen, the investor who is trying to open the arena down in SoDo, the city of Seattle was saying that they were concerned that this was going to interrupt port operations. And in this terminal in particular, Terminal 46, was one of their biggest concerns. And what we have found is that terminal operator is already struggling. And so, you know, that and shipping through that port terminal has already dwindled. So the argument that this is going to dramatically impact the port's operations is starting to kind of fall away. And if this terminal operator pulls out because it goes bankrupt, then obviously that argument against locating the arena in Soto will go away.
In fact, you report that the port has looked into the idea of abandoning that as a shipping terminal and turning it into a cruise ship facility. How serious is that?
Well, they have looked at it. They've looked at a couple of different options for Terminal 46. One of the problems with that terminal is that there's no rail yard there. And so that it's already, you know, kind of a difficult terminal to work with. For that reason, they've looked at cruise ship operations. They've looked at putting the port's headquarters on that space. Right now, they're saying that, you know, they're not seriously considering any of that because they have a functioning terminal operator in there. But if that changes, I think the discussion around the use for that terminal is going to change as well.
Would that terminal shrinkage be an economic hit?
Absolutely. The Port of Seattle says that that's about $370 million operation there. There's thousands of jobs that are going to be affected by that. And, you know, plus it's just another empty space basically on the waterfront that's not getting utilized.
So the big decision this last spring was the Seattle City Council saying, no, we're not going to give you private use of this street. And we've been asking these council members, and they've been hard to get a comment out of on this. Have you heard any of the council members suggest that, well, things are slowing down at the port, maybe we will revisit, and now that Chris Hansen's offering to pony up more of his own money, yeah, maybe we'll change our vote?
We have not heard that from them, although I suspect that they're watching this very closely for that exact reason. You know, if we could bring more economic activity to Soto, that seems like that would be a net win for everybody, especially if the terminal is struggling and we're not seeing as much economic activity connected to that.
So there's that working in the stadium's favor, and Russell Wilson is on board, too.
That helps.
That doesn't hurt. That's Emily Parkhurst laying out the situation for you there in Soto and on the working waterfront. She is editor-in-chief of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Good to see you again, Emily. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. We are on Facebook, as you know, and on Twitter, at KUOW.